I want to tonight go into Say's Law of Markets. We didn't completely finish the discussion of productionism versus consumptionism. Maybe there'll be some opportunity to go back to that, but I do want to start off with a discussion of Say's Law. Say was an early 19th century French economist who was a popularizer of the ideas of Adam Smith in France. I have in parenthesis James Mill's Law of Markets. James Mill was an early 19th century British economist who, in my judgment, gave a sounder exposition than even Say. To understand what Say's Law is all about, we have to begin by making a distinction between two concepts of demand. One is monetary demand, which we've been working with up to now. That can be understood as the amount of money spent to buy goods or services, the amount of money spent. That's the D in our equation. The price level equals D divided by S. That's monetary demand. Then there is a further concept, real demand, which is different than monetary demand. Real demand can be understood as the monetary demand adjusted for changes in the wage and price level. It's the monetary demand adjusted for changes in the wage and price level, or perhaps better still, it's the goods and services the monetary demand actually buys. The real demand is the goods and services you're actually able to buy by virtue of the money you spend. The goods and services, what you can actually obtain for the money you spend, that's the real demand. And there can be a profound difference between real demand and monetary demand to the extent that a smaller monetary demand at one point in time can very well represent a larger real demand than a larger monetary demand at another point in time. So it would be possible, for example, for today's 12 trillion of monetary demand to be a larger real demand, taking monetary demand today as equal roughly to current GDP, today's monetary demand as represented by today's GDP of 12 trillion could very well turn out to be a larger real demand than some future monetary demand of 120 trillion if when the monetary demand got to be 120 trillion prices had increased by more than tenfold. Imagine that some year in the future, maybe 25, 50 years from now, monetary GDP is up to 120 trillion, and by that time, prices are 20 times higher. Well, how much would 120 trillion buy compared to what today's 12 trillion buys if prices were 20 times higher? Depend on what? Pardon me?
Real demand.
Well, what would real demand be if, how much would you get for 120 trillion if prices were 20 times what they are today? Yes?
One half.
One half as much. The real demand would be half as great as it is today if prices were 20 times higher. So it's possible for a smaller monetary demand to represent a larger real demand than a larger monetary demand. It depends on prices. Another way to look at the same thing, it's not all that long since the Italian lira disappeared. But which represented a larger real demand? A million Italian lira or 1,000 US dollars? 1,000 US dollars. The lira had an exchange rate of, I think, about 1,600 or so to the dollar. $1,000 was the equivalent of 1,600,000 lira. So a mere million lira was worth less than $1,000. It would buy less. represented a lesser real demand. So the number of monetary units that are spent, that does not signify anything about the height of real demand. To know real demand, you have to know not just the monetary demand, but also the price level. The monetary demand, the extent to which it's a real demand, depends on the price level. Now, according to productionism, which we spent a lot of time on last week, as I put it in point three, there is no inherent limit to aggregate real demand. Aggregate real demand has no fixed limit. And we represented that by drawing an asymptotic demand curve. There is no inherent limit. Potentially, aggregate real demand is unlimited. There's no limit to our need and desire for wealth. That's potentially unlimited. The actual limit at any given time depends on the willingness and ability of people to produce. That's what I italicize here. Real demand, while it has no inherent limit, no potential limit, its actual limit depends on the willingness and ability of people to produce. If they're willing and able to produce more, then what will happen in the face of a given monetary demand? Suppose the monetary demand is an unchanged number of dollars, however many billions or trillions, and we assume that's unchanged. What will happen if and to the extent that people become able and willing to produce more, and this larger volume of output is sold for the same given expenditure of money?
More value in the real demand.
There'll be greater real demand, because what will be happening to prices? And you are, I'm sorry, I don't see your name there. Okay, Mr. Davis, thank you.
Prices would fall.
Prices would fall. And what would be the effect of that on the ability of the same aggregate expenditure to buy goods and services?
You'd buy more.
Now, we can illustrate this. If people are able and willing to produce more, then given the monetary demand, the price level will drop and the real demand will be increased. The actual quantity demanded is determined by the aggregate supply curve, which can be shown as a vertical line SS. And here we have it. Let's see if we can enlarge this. Okay. Can you all see this in the rear? Okay, it's titled Productionism and Say's Law. Notice we've got the productionist aggregate demand curve, the same one we were looking at last time. The only difference is now we've added in various aggregate supply curves, or you can call them aggregate supply lines. Of course, we're showing them as just so much. If we have this initial aggregate supply, SS, equal to a quantity 1.0, then that generates a price level of 1.0. And what is the quantity demanded along this demand curve at the price level 1.0?
One.
So the quantity demanded is equal to the supply available at that price level. Now, what would happen if we could double the aggregate supply to S prime S prime? This is a quantity of 2.0. What would be required for that to be demanded? All right, if the price level is halved, then the quantity demanded would be doubled with the same expenditure. Twice the volume of supply in the face of the same expenditure of money would halve the price level and make that same expenditure adequate to buy the doubled supply. And similarly, if the supply were to quadruple, well, the same expenditure would be sufficient to buy quadruple the supply at what price level?
1/4.
At 1/4, and 8 times at an eighth, 10 times at a tenth, and on without limit, 100 times at 100. Yes, Mr. Wright.
In this curve, then, do wages remain static?
Okay, a very good question. What's happening to wages here? What is happening to wages? That's a very important question. Well, that will depend on what's happening to the supply of labor. Now, there are two possibilities. When production increases, there are basically two possible sources of an increase in production. One is that people are doing correspondingly more work, and we have the same output per unit of labor. We're applying more units. There could be more hours per worker, or it could be more people working. Now, to that extent, if we had the same quantity of money and the same volume of payrolls in the economy, if there were the same total payrolls, and we have more and more units of labor contending for the same total payrolls, what would be the effect on the wage per unit of labor? Yes, Mr. Woody? It would be going down exactly as this. Imagine that we had, on the one side in the economy, say the demand for consumers' goods is $12 trillion, roughly today's GDP. Imagine that at the same time, total payrolls were $10 trillion. And the total payrolls remain $10 trillion, the total consumer spending remained $12 trillion. And now if in 50 years, the only change were that we had twice the people working, performing twice the labor, well, we could presumably produce twice as much, very possibly. In that case, what would be the effect on prices? They'd be halved. But what would also be the effect on wages? They'd be halved. But now there's a different way that the output can be increased. And what would that be, apart from the increase in the supply of labor?
Technology.
Economic progress, scientific and technological progress, capital accumulation, a rise in the productivity of labor. So now suppose that what is responsible is not more labor, we have the same labor, assume, but it's become twice as productive. We're producing twice as much per unit of labor on the average. So the supply of products has doubled, and so what will happen to the prices of products? They'll have, but the supply of labor hasn't increased. We have the same supply of labor and the same monetary demand for labor, so what would be true of wage rates? They would be unchanged. Money wage rates would be unchanged. But what would have happened to real wage rates, understood as the goods and services the worker can actually obtain with the money he earns? They would have doubled. The doubling of production, in this case, would have doubled real wages. To the extent that increases in production proceed from increases in the output per unit of labor, the effect is to raise real wages. And the effect of any increase in production, whether it's from more output per worker or from more workers, either way, it will increase the real demand for output. Now, let's look at a couple of implications of Say's law, which we actually have here. You can understand the meaning of Say's law. Notice what is determining where real demand actually is at any given point, at any given time. What is it that puts real demand here, then puts it here, then here, then here, then here? It's supply. What is determining real demand is supply. Aggregate real demand is being determined by aggregate supply. See, if we took away these supply lines, and we'd have this productionist aggregate demand curve, that's showing that real demand is potentially limitless, but at any given time, it is something definite, and what's determining where it is at any given time is aggregate production and supply. And this is Say's law. Say's law is most often stated as supply creates its own demand. That's the most popular shorthand statement of Say's law. Supply creates its own demand. And that should be understood in the light of this kind of diagram, that in the face of a given aggregate expenditure of money, more production and supply are enlarging the quantity demanded to absorb the additional production and supply by way of bringing down prices. And if it's a larger supply of labor that's involved, bringing down wage rates too. Now, what's the implication of this as to how much output could potentially be sold and how many workers could potentially be employed? Is there any fixed limit?
There's no limits.
No, there is no limit. It depends on how much output we can produce and how many people there are able and willing to work. If the wage and price level can adjust to the available quantity of money and the volume of spending that quantity of money will support.
Wouldn't the only caveat to that statement be a particular product they were producing may have certain limitations as to the demand, so labor might have to shift to a different area of production?
Oh yeah, but notice the proposition refers to aggregate real demand, economy-wide real demand. Now, there are some products, the best illustration perhaps is table salt. Table salt is a case, I think, where people have long been sated. No one is waiting for the price of table salt to fall before he salts his steak more heavily. So we could assume that if labor became more productive in the making of table salt, we wouldn't want any more. Maybe there are alternative uses for table salt, then we might want more. But we wouldn't want more to salt our food. And if that were the only use for it, then as we could produce the same quantity of table salt with less and less labor, what would happen to the number of workers employed in table salt? They'd be going down. But are there any things that we would like more of? Is everything in the position of table salt? Are most things? No. So to the extent that we could produce table salt or anything in its position with less labor, we'd have more labor available to produce more of other things, which we certainly do want. And there's a ready and waiting outlet for other things. Things that people would like to have but previously could not afford. So just think of all of the things we'd like to have but can't afford. Well, what do we need to be able to afford them? Pardon me? Okay, now you say more money. If you alone...
More real money.
More real money. You see, any one individual, it would be reasonable for any one individual, if he has more money, well, that's the road to him getting more goods, certainly. But if we had the same production, and if there's the same total supply available, and one individual is spending more money, what is implied about the goods and services remaining to others? That would be that much less. And if we had the same output being produced and sold, but more money is spent to buy it, what's the effect on prices? There would be higher prices. Now, you see, many, many people have believed that the key to getting more goods is just getting more money. But if that were true, there'd be no reason for any country anywhere in the world to be poor. All they would need is one printing press, create more of their money, and then they would presumably have prosperity. But what is the actual effect of mere money creation without any corresponding increase in the production and supply of goods? Then you have rising prices. If you think in terms of our price level formula, the price level equals the aggregate monetary demand divided by the supply. If we double the quantity of money and volume of spending while the supply remains the same, what happens to prices? If we double the spending to buy the same quantity of goods, what would happen to prices? They would go up. How much? They would double. Well, now, if there's twice the expenditure and you have to pay twice the prices, would such an increased monetary demand represent an increased real demand? No, it would not. There would not be any additional real demand accompanying merely an increase in monetary demand. And this is a point I wanted to make very soon. So let's jump there, since that's where we are. This is point seven. Particularly point A, subpoint A under seven. More monetary demand without more supply just means higher prices, and thus no additional real demand. More monetary demand by itself is not sufficient to create more real demand. If all we have is more monetary demand, we'll just have higher prices, and the larger expenditure will not buy any more than the smaller expenditure. So more money is really not the fundamental answer to more real demand. It's fallacious at the level of the economy as a whole. What does it take so that when there is more money in spending, for prices not to go up as much as the volume of spending, with the result that the larger spending becomes enabled to buy more than the smaller spending did? They have to have more production. To take the simplest case, what would be required so that double the money and double the spending would succeed in becoming a doubled real demand? We'd have to have double the volume of production. If we had that, if there's twice the spending to buy now twice the goods, what would be the effect on the price level?
The
it would be the same. It would be unchanged. So two times the spending at the same prices, that will be a doubled real demand. But what is it that allows the price level to be unchanged when spending doubles? What makes it possible for the price level to be unchanged when spending doubles?
Production.
That production must double. If production doubles, then double the spending can represent double the real demand. But notice, for more money and spending ever to represent more real demand, it's necessary, it's essential, that they be accompanied by correspondingly more production and supply. If they're not, if there's no increase in production and supply, there's no increase in real demand. So a way to put this is, as I say it in point B, it takes more supply. It requires more supply to make a larger monetary demand into a larger real demand. Thus, more supply is necessary for the creation of more real demand. More monetary demand by itself is not sufficient. It wouldn't do the job. If that were all that were present, there'd be no increase in real demand emanating from more monetary demand. Only to the extent that it's accompanied by more production and supply can a larger monetary demand ever represent a larger real demand. But notice further, and this is point C, but it doesn't take more monetary demand. It doesn't take more monetary demand to create a larger real demand. More supply will do it by itself with the same monetary demand by way of reducing prices. And if it's a larger supply of labor that's in question, wage rates. So if we have more production and supply, we can have more real demand with or without more money. But if all we have is more money, we won't have more real demand. It's more production and supply that are the essential element in greater real demand, not more money. Is that clear, that it's production and supply that are the essential thing for more real demand? That if they're present, then a greater monetary demand will be a greater real demand, because prices will not rise to the same extent as the volume of spending. But if more monetary demand isn't present, there'll still be a greater real demand through a fall in prices. It's more production and supply that are the essential element in more real demand. And I say here in the concluding paragraph, thus more supply is both necessary and sufficient for the creation of real demand, more real demand. That's all you need, is more production and supply. You'll have more real demand, with or without more monetary demand. So supply, not more money, is what counts for real demand. More money is neither necessary nor sufficient. Only more supply creates more real demand. Okay. Now, let me try to zero in on what Say's Law refers to. I have this point, the reference of Say's Law. What is it pertaining to? And I say there are two elements I stress. Aggregate, or economy-wide demand, in real terms. Perhaps I shouldn't have the word demand stressed. The stress should be on aggregate or economy-wide and real. It's demand in the aggregate, in real terms. Economy-wide demand in real terms. The economy-wide and the real are the two elements to stress. The economy-wide demand in real terms. That's what Say's Law refers to. And this is something that, Mr. Wilson?
Just kind of one clarification. When you say economy-wide, that can be in reference to like a single country or even global, depending on the nature of that industry?
Depending on the context, it might be the economy just of a country. If practically all economic activity that went on in a country was within its own borders, then it would be a countrywide. If the context has changed and the country is intimately involved in the world market extensively, then the economy-wide would probably have to be taken globally. So it depends on the context. Now, what is important to realize is, which is often overlooked, that Say's Law does not refer to things industry by industry or company by company. It is not saying, definitely not saying, that if the supply of the product of any particular industry increases, that this will result in correspondingly more real demand for the products of that industry. That might happen, or it might not happen. That's perfectly possible that when the supply of a particular industry increases, the real demand for the product of that industry might actually decrease. But what Say's Law refers to is the effect of the larger supply of the product of an industry on real demand in the economy as a whole. Larger supply on demand in the economy as a whole.
Can you think of examples?
I'll be giving you examples. We'll see that very, very shortly. We'll be dealing with a case in which a particular industry produces more. The real demand for its product actually declines. Yet, at the same time, economy-wide real demand increases. And what actually is brought out in such a case, as I put it at the end of this paragraph, is that the larger supply of the product itself is what constitutes the larger real demand in the economy as a whole. It's the larger supply of the product itself that constitutes the larger real demand in the economy as a whole. Now, we need to concretize this, and this is what point C is all about, the confirmation of Say's Law by cases apparently contradicting it. And I refer to the potato example, first in barter, then in money. Now, here we are. I pick potatoes because potatoes are a good that in every significant country, virtually everybody has all of the potatoes he'd like to have. People are not particularly eager to get more potatoes. Now, let's assume the supply of potatoes were to double. Imagine that there was some discovery made that enabled the potato growers in a very short time to produce double the supply of potatoes. But we're not keen to have double the supply of potatoes. The use for the extra supply might end up being just to feed pigs or something of that kind. And what kind of price would be required in order to find buyers for this doubled supply? Much lower. I assume you're all familiar with the concept of an inelastic demand. Mm-hmm. Well, the demand for potatoes is highly inelastic, which would mean if the supply of potatoes were to double, the price would fall by more than half. Now, for analytical purposes, we need to choose convenient numbers to make our work as easy as possible. So the first simple integer fraction that is less than a half is a third. So if we assume that when the supply of potatoes doubles, the price will fall to a third, well, what's that imply about expenditure on potatoes? If there's twice the supply of potatoes that are sold at one-third the price, what's the answer to the higher mathematical problem, 2 times 1/3? Two-thirds. So that's the revenue of the potato growers. They take in less revenue. And let's initially develop this in the context of a barter economy where it's goods exchanging against goods. In the barter economy, the potato growers would be bringing their potatoes to market. They would trade some of the bushels for eggs, other bushels for shoes, other bushels for iron nails, on and on and on. And now we've got the potato growers coming to market with twice the quantity of potatoes. And what's fallen is the exchange ratios in barter. So it used to be perhaps that a bushel of potatoes would exchange for 12 eggs. Now a bushel of potatoes exchanges for 4 eggs, one-third the barter price. A bushel of potatoes previously exchanged for 3 yards of cloth. Now it exchanges for 1 yard of cloth, and on, one-third. All right, what would be implied about the physical volume of goods being given to the potato growers in exchange for their doubled supply of potatoes? How much less? One third less. It would be two thirds of what it used to be. Yes, Mr. Whitesides.
So you're not factoring in government subsidies. You're just saying in a free market, right?
Yeah, we'll make it as uncomplicated as possible.
Right.
So we can put aside things like subsidies. Here we are. We simply have twice the output of potatoes, and the barter price falls to one third. So what is the situation of the potato growers?
Lose money.
All right, they're taking in less than before. Now, the reason I bring this case up is here are the potato growers. They've doubled their supply, right?
Right.
And Say's law is maintaining that when the supply increases, that's what brings about an increase in demand. Supply creates its own demand. Well, the potato growers, if they didn't pay careful attention to what Say's law actually meant, they would think, here they are. They are offering 2 bushels of potatoes. They used to get 3 units of other goods for, let this represent a bushel of potatoes. They used to get 3 units of other goods for their 1 bushel of potatoes. Now they're getting 1 unit for 1 bushel. They also have a second bushel, so they take in 2 units. Notice the other goods demand for potatoes. The demand for potatoes in terms of goods other than potatoes, it used to be 3 units, now it's 2, right? So from the perspective of the potato growers, it would appear, here we are, we've got more supply, what's happened to the damn demand? It's supposed to be more, but it's less, right? Now, this is an apparent contradiction if you're forgetting the context, if you're ignoring the fact that Say's law is not about the individual industry, it's about the economy as a whole. And even though the real demand for potatoes has fallen from 3 to 2, accompanying the doubling of the supply, real demand in the economy as a whole will increase to precisely the same extent as the increase in the supply of potatoes. Now, how does that work? Well, here we are, the producers of goods other than potatoes, they're no longer giving this unit to the potato growers. So the egg producer has 4 eggs left over. The cloth producer has a yard of cloth left over. And on, case by case. What are these producers doing with the goods they no longer have to give to the potato growers? They exchange them among themselves. So there is a reduced demand in terms of goods other than potatoes for potatoes. But what has happened to the demand for things other than potatoes in terms of things other than potatoes? It's gone up. There's one less for potatoes, one more for things other than potatoes. Okay? Now, the kicker is, what has happened to the demand for things other than potatoes in terms of potatoes? In a barter economy, when the potato growers go shopping, what is the currency that they're using to obtain the things that they want?
Potatoes.
And what has happened to the volume of potatoes that they're offering in exchange for things other than potatoes? They're offering twice the potatoes. So there are 3 components of demand involved here. There's the other goods demand for potatoes. The other goods demand for potatoes. And this is what I've got up here in table 13.1. The other goods demand for potatoes is down by one-third. The other goods demand for other goods is up by an equivalent amount, as the customers of the potato growers use their savings from the purchase of potatoes in exchange with one another. So to this extent, what has happened? If we look simply at elements one and two, where are we in terms of economy-wide aggregate demand?
Unchanged.
It's unchanged. There's a drop for the potato growers, an equivalent increase for the producers of things other than potatoes. But now there's the third element. The potato demand for other goods is increased by an amount precisely equal to the increase in the supply of potatoes brought to the market. There's twice the potato demand for everything else. There's twice the potatoes offered for shoes, twice the potatoes offered for eggs, twice the potatoes offered for cloth, everything. And if we add up all of the components of demand, we see the other goods demand for potatoes is down some. The other goods demand for other goods is up equivalently. The potato demand for other goods has increased to precisely the same extent as the increase in the supply of potatoes. And the total aggregate demand has changed by the sum of these three items together. The effect on aggregate demand is the sum of items 1, 2, and 3 together. And when we add that up, then what is the effect on economy-wide aggregate demand? It's increased. You say it's the same? It's increased to the extent of the increase in the supply of potatoes. Now, we will come to the exact same result when we go over the case in terms of a monetary economy. Now, we'll drop the assumption of barter and assume everyone is selling his goods or services for money. So here are the potato growers. They come to market and they've got twice the supply of potatoes. And we'll assume that the money price of potatoes drops to one-third. The money price of potatoes is going to be one-third of what it used to be. Well, what's the effect of that on the sales revenues of the potato industry?
One-third.
That's, it's two-thirds of what it used to be, right? Now, what are people doing with the money that they used to spend in buying potatoes but no longer do? I mean, they're spending it on other things, right? So the total aggregate demand in terms of money is unchanged. There's less for potatoes, equivalently more for the rest of the economy. And what has happened to the economy-wide aggregate supply that this unchanged monetary demand now buys? It's increased to what extent?
Two-thirds.
Two-thirds.
Which is increased in the proportion of the decrease in the potatoes?
Well, what good has increased? What element of supply has increased?
Other.
Dollars.
Potatoes have increased. Potatoes is the only thing that's increased. The only good whose physical supply has increased is potatoes. There's twice the supply of potatoes. There's twice the supply of everything else is unchanged. The total amount of money spent in the economy is unchanged. Less of it is spent for potatoes, more of it is spent for other goods, but that's a wash. And what does the same total amount of money spent now buy compared to what it used to buy?
More goods.
It buys more to the extent there's more potatoes.
Just like your table salt.
Well, it's similar, I guess, but in this case, there is more potatoes. Now, naturally, from the perspective of the economy as a whole, the potato industry is small potatoes. So when the supply of potatoes doubles, if we translate that into terms of economy-wide aggregate supply, well, that's certainly not a doubling of economy-wide aggregate supply. If we took the potato industry as representing 0.1% of the whole economy, which maybe it roughly does, I don't know. If it represented 0.1% and now it's doubled, then how big is the new aggregate supply compared to the original aggregate supply? What's the increase if potatoes have doubled and potatoes represent 0.1%? Well, it's increased by 0.1%. Whatever it was, the initial amount is 100. Take the initial supply as 100, and now we add 0.1%. We add 1.001, I guess, the total aggregate supply will be 1.001 larger than it was before. And if the same total expenditure is now buying 1.001 what it used to buy, well, what has happened to the real demand? What's happened to real demand? It's increased. To what extent? To 0.001, which is the exact same extent to which the supply of potatoes taken as part of aggregate supply has increased. So at the aggregate level, the increase in the supply of potatoes is increasing economy-wide aggregate demand, even though the potato growers are suffering. See, if you look at things merely from the perspective of one industry, you can come to the conclusion that Say's law is nuts. Here's more supply, and in a case like this, the demand is less for that industry. But that's not what Say's law is about. Say's law is about economy-wide aggregate demand in real terms. And when you keep that in mind, then aggregate demand has indeed increased to the exact same extent as the increase in supply. And this is always the case with respect to aggregate real demand. And I think perhaps it's easiest to grasp in the conditions of barter. If we were exchanging goods for goods, what would be required to increase demand? What would be required so that the people you were dealing with who were trading for your goods were offering more to you? What would have to be going on for the average seller to be receiving more from other producers?
Mass production on your end.
For the average seller in the economic system to be receiving more from other producers. In a barter economy. Pardon me?
Supply would have to increase.
Supply would have to increase. I think Mr. Sweeney was coming to that too. See, just think, in order for the producers of shoes to be taking in more eggs, wheat, cloth, nails, whatever, and the producers of everything, pretty much, to be taking in more of everything, what has to be going on?
There has to be more of those things to
More of those things have to be produced. More things have to be produced. In a barter economy, the way things are acquired in exchange is by offering products. And in order to have more aggregate demand, you need to have more production and supply. Well, that is true in a monetary economy, too, in terms of real demand.
Let's try to follow that completely. Maybe you can explain it a different way. I think in terms of supply and demand, as far as if there's less supply, then the demand for that product is higher. If there's less supply, the dollar value for that product is higher.
If there is less supply of a particular product, it may be sometimes that the total dollar value will be higher. And that's the case in the potato example, right? Suppose we just reversed it. Suppose we started off, the potato growers are producing their larger production, and they're taking in 2 units of money where they used to take in 3. And what would be the effect if they now produced, went back to their earlier production of just 1 unit? Then they'd be taking in 3 units of money, right? But is that would be an increase in the monetary demand for potatoes, right? Okay, but what would it imply about the monetary demand for things other than potatoes?
Reduces.
Go down.
All right, and how much would the same total monetary demand across the whole economy now be buying? It would be buying less to the extent there were less potatoes. It's very often in economics, people make a confusion because of these circumstances. It's true that very often when there is less supply, the monetary value of that industry will be higher. When there's a greater supply, it will be lower. That, in fact, is the case we're dealing with. And the confusion that is often made was identified quite a few generations ago, as a confusion between monetary value and riches or real wealth. And if you ever have the time, there's one of the major economic classics by an early classical economist named David Ricardo, a book called Principles of Political Economy and Taxation, and one of his chapters is Value and Riches, Their Distinctive Properties. And what you see, it's true that sometimes a lesser supply may enrich the producers in that particular industry. But can it enrich the economic system? If there's a smaller supply of potatoes, that might temporarily enrich the potato growers. But what is its effect on wealth in the economic system as a totality? It reduces it, because to the extent that the potato growers have more monetary value, what's the effect on the monetary value of other industries? It's that much less. And overall, we have the same monetary value, and what's it buying? What's the same total monetary value now buying?
Less.
So the real demand is less. The real demand is less when the supply is less. Now, you could increase the total monetary demand across the board, but to the extent you do that and there's no increase in supply, is there any increase in real demand?
No.
No. Okay. So here, I think this is this table spells it out. The way it works out is the increase in aggregate real demand comes down to the increase in the supply of potatoes itself. The increase in demand is felt not by the potato growers, but by the producers of things other than potatoes. They experience a twofold increase in the demand for their products. Where is the increase in demand for things like shoes, eggs, cloth, etc.? What are the sources of the increase in demand for these things other than potatoes? There's two elements to the increase in their demand.
Production.
Pardon me?
Production.
I'm sorry?
Production.
Well, in a certain sense, but more specifically.
The other goods.
Yes?
The other goods.
The producers of things other than potatoes are benefiting from the reduction in the demand for potatoes in terms of other goods. They're getting what used to go to the potato growers.
Right.
That's one element. Mm-hmm. So the potato growers are taking in less, that's true, but the producers of things other than potatoes, they're taking in that much more. That's point two versus point one. And then further, the demand for goods other than potatoes, is increased by the additional supply of potatoes. So the demand for things other than potatoes goes up for two causes. One of them is equal to the decline in demand for potatoes, and the other is the increase in the supply of potatoes. And that's the overall net increase. Now, this example of the potato growers is actually very, very pregnant intellectually. It's pregnant. It will deliver more enlightening material. It's filled with meaning. And this leads us into the next point, Say's law and economic adjustment, partial relative overproduction, but never general or absolute overproduction. Now, let's look at the plight of the potato growers. Here they are. They've doubled their output, but what's happened to their standard of living? It's sharply reduced. But the standard of living of people outside the potato industry is more than equivalently increased. It's increased, A, equivalent to the reduction of the potato growers, and B, increased further by the increase in the supply of potatoes. So the gain is greater than the loss. But if this situation of the low price of potatoes is going to be protracted, what's implied about the profitability of continuing to be a potato grower? It's not as worthwhile as giving up potato growing and going out into other lines. Now, here we are. The potato growers are initially earning less than they used to earn. The immediate effect of their doubling of production is they're earning only two-thirds what they used to earn. We could reasonably expect that some of the potato growers will quit potato growing, right? Now, as they do, what will happen to the supply of potatoes?
Increase.
It'll go down. It'll be less than double. It will retreat from double. Now, if we assume that every potato grower, each and every grower, had become twice as productive, that each and every grower could now grow twice the potatoes that he could to begin with, how many potato growers would have to leave to...
50%.
Well, 50% would have to leave to get back to the old supply of potatoes.
Right.
Now, if we got back to the old supply of potatoes and the old price of potatoes, the initial price, then anyone who is producing potatoes at the initial price and producing twice as many, what would be his income?
Double.
He would have double the income. He'd be a prince in the economic system. So that would be too big a reduction. Now just think, what kind of price of potatoes would be necessary to enable the remaining potato growers, on the assumption that they can now produce two bushels as easily as they used to produce one, what sort of price would be required so that you'd at least earn the same revenue and income on the two bushels that you used to earn on the one? Not two-thirds the revenue, but the same revenue. What supply, or rather, what price of potatoes would be required so that those who remained as potato growers would earn at least the same kind of income they did? Yeah, if the price of potatoes could be brought up from one-third to one-half of its initial level, getting it up from one-third to one-half, then whoever remained as a potato grower would at least be earning as good an income as he did at the beginning, right? Now, pardon me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, is there some supply of potatoes that is less than double, but more than the initial supply that should produce a price of one half? There must be some supply. Now, we don't know in advance what it is. I mean, it's conceivable that the supply required to get the price to one half might be, instead of the doubled supply, 1.1. Or it could be 1.8. Now, in order to make our mental work as easy as possible, we'll pick an easier number to work with. We'll assume 1.5. We'll assume if the supply of potatoes could be brought down from double to 3/2, right in the middle, that would be sufficient to get the price up to 1/2. There has to be some price, and we could alter the example to go some supply, and we could alter the example, but it would be more complicated. So, assuming that it's 3/2 the initial supply, that satisfies the basic requirement. The supply needs to be reduced. We pick a simple level to which it needs to be reduced. Now, if the supply needs to be cut from double to 3/2, and the average grower is producing double, how many growers do we need now to produce 3/2? Each grower produces twice what he used to. What times 2 equals 3/2? 75%, 3/4. 2 times 3/4, that's 6/4, that's 1.5. So 3/4 the growers will now serve to produce 3/2 the supply. And when 3/2 the supply is produced, then what's the income of the average grower? The same as it was to begin with. And 1/4 of the growers have left. They've fanned out through the rest of the economic system. No one may know exactly where each of them has gone, but they are around in different locations. And as they move into the rest of the economy, what will be the effect on the premium incomes that had temporarily been earned elsewhere? They'll diminish. So now, where would we end up in terms of the average level of money incomes in the economic system? I'm sorry?
An equilibrium is achieved at that.
There's an equilibrium, and the equilibrium, I think, is implied at a level of money income that's no different than it was at the very beginning. The average member of the economy would be earning the same amount of money he did before. Initially, or temporarily, people outside of potato growing earned somewhat of a premium. People in potato growing were suffering terribly. And now they're no longer suffering. They've worked their way back up. The premiums are eliminated. So the potato growers are back up. They're earning comparable incomes to what everyone else is earning. There's no premium elsewhere. But there's a significant difference, and that is, what is the price of potatoes?
Half of what it was.
It's half of what it was initially. And what is implied about the amount of money the average member of the economy spends in buying potatoes, this 50% larger amount, how much does the average person spend in buying the 50% more? I'm hearing the same half.
How much are they spending to buy 50% more? How much are they spending to buy the same?
How much are they spending to buy whatever it is, the 50% more that they're buying? They're getting, the average member of the economy is getting three halves the potatoes, right?
Right.
And the price of potatoes is one half of what it was. So how much is the average person spending to obtain three halves the potatoes?
Same.
75%. What is three halves times one half? You're getting three, the average buyer is getting three halves the potatoes. Not each and every individual. There are some who might not buy any more. There are some who buy double. The average buyer is getting three halves the quantity of potatoes at one half the price. So how much money is the average buyer spending on his potatoes? What's three halves times one half? 3/4, which is, of course, 75%. Three halves times one half, three halves the quantity, times one half the price is 3/4 the expenditure. So the average person is spending 3/4 as much as he used to in buying potatoes, and he's getting 50% more potatoes. Now, what is the average person doing with the 25% of the money he used to spend in buying potatoes? He's buying other things. And now, what is there present that makes possible a physical expansion in the production of these other things? Isn't the labor, there's 1/4 of the labor released from potato growing. 1/4 of the labor has been released from potato growing. They're available to step up the production of the other things that people are buying with the money they save from potato growing, from buying potatoes. Now, if we look at the effect of this on all of the relevant parties in the economy, if you never had any connection with potato growing at all, except as a consumer, what's the long-run effect of these developments on you after the dust has settled? You're getting 50% more potatoes for 3/4 the expenditure, and you have that money left over, and that enables you to obtain more of other things, which can actually be produced on the foundation of the labor released from potato growing. It doesn't mean that the ex-potato growers themselves have to produce precisely the things you are buying. They can bump other people who then go to produce those other things. Yes, Mr. Rosendahl?
My question is, what if that additional 25% that's spent on potatoes spent elsewhere is not spent but saved?
Right, even if it's saved, when money is saved, what is done with the savings?
Lent out.
They're lent out, yeah.
What if it's not saved in the conventional manner? What if the person puts it under their pillow?
All right, now, if we had a situation where people decide they want to increase their cash holdings, what would that do to the volume of spending? The overall volume of spending.
It would decrease.
It would decrease. There'd be a lesser volume of expenditure. Then the system would have to adjust at a lower level of wages and prices. But we'll assume that people have satisfactory cash holdings. They don't want to put the money under the mattress. They are prepared to spend as much as before, but they'll just spend it in different lines. I think that's the much more reasonable assumption. So now, in this way, we've seen that the great body of people who were only related to potatoes as consumers, they have a clear benefit. Even after the dust has settled, they're getting more potatoes for a lesser expenditure, which permits them also to get more of other things that are produced on the foundation of labor released from potato growing. All right, what's the situation with respect to people who used to be potato growers and who had to get out of potato growing and fan out into the rest of the economy? Once they've learned other lines of work to the same extent as they used to know potato growing, what kind of incomes should we expect them to make in other lines? Pardon? Comparable incomes to what they had been making in potato growing. Now, if they do, then what's the effect on them? The same as the effect on the great mass of people. They will benefit ultimately from the improvement that initially displaced them. they'll be earning, after they've retrained and adapted, they'll be earning a comparable level of income in some other line, and then they too, in their capacity as consumers, will be faced with a lower price of potatoes, get more of them for less expenditure, and have the means left over to buy more of other things. And then finally, what about those who have remained in potato growing? What's the effect on them after potato growing has been cut back from double to 1.5? And they're earning a comparable level of income to what they had been.
Their quality of life has gone up.
They've improved too. So the long run effect is that everybody improves. And I think you can see this plainly illustrated historically. We've had radical improvements in agricultural production. What have many, many of the sons and daughters of farmers had to do, because it was not economical to stay on the farms? They'd find employment elsewhere. And what's been the effect on the standard of living of everybody of these improvements? And what was the effect, do you think, on the standard of living of the blacksmiths of the coming of the automobile for those blacksmiths who made an adjustment and found another line of work? It ended up improved too. They too got the benefit of the automobile. Mr. Winchell, I didn't mean to put you off.
In your example, there's 25% more potatoes available for half the price.
50% more.
Well, 50%, yeah. But what happens if somebody doesn't want to buy more potatoes? Now, you know, everybody's on the low cholesterol diets and they decide,
okay,
potatoes for me.
All right, so then the price would drop more steeply. Then we'd conceivably, we could have a duplication of the table salt case. Change the example. Imagine that the productivity of labor of in the production of table salt doubled, and we don't want any more table salt. Well, how would things end up that in that case? We'd have half the number of people producing the same quantity of table salt, and they'd fan out through the rest of the economy. What would be the effect on total production and on real demand?
So then more people just leave the potato industry and go into other industries.
Yeah, if we didn't want any more potatoes, then you'd have to have a bigger drop. And even perhaps to the point where we end up with just the same quantity of potatoes. But then there's still a gain. We get more output in other lines. And those who remain, once you get down to just half the producers, they would earn the same level of incomes they used to earn, and in their capacity as consumers, they'd be getting the same salt more easily, and they'd have the ability to buy more of other things too.
The yes. Flip side of that is you now have potato growers that are also skilled in another trade.
That they have to learn something.
So you have really improved their way of life, because if the new trade that they're in starts to fall, they could take a look at the potato growing and say, do I want to get back in?
Well,
that,
can see,
or they'd retrain again.
Well, they'd have to retrain again. Now, the retraining issue will be different for different people. There are different periods of retraining. I think you need to look at it at least three broad levels. The level of unskilled labor. How long does it take to learn a typical unskilled job? Inconsequential. Maybe weeks, sometimes days or hours. So that's not an extensive retraining period. The unskilled workers, really, if you had a fully free labor market, they need have virtually no short-run loss. If it's skilled workers and you have a kind of skill that took us several years to acquire, well then, to acquire the same degree of skill in another line might take you that long before you'd earn a comparable level of income. And there would be many cases where people wouldn't earn a comparable level of income, and they'd be thereafter working at a lower level. So they might be set back for a very long time, or maybe for the rest of their lives. A more extreme case is someone who loses an invested fortune. Suppose you had $1 million invested in 1900 in a buggy whip factory, and you lose that. But I think it's generally much more difficult to re-earn a fortune than it is to acquire another job skill. And if you want to ask what's the effect in such cases where people will never make it back, I would say even then, if you take the real long view, they don't have a legitimate complaint. Just think of the effects of this process of improving production going back over a long period of time. What is it that enables any of us, to have the kind of standard of living that we now have? What is it the reflection of looking back over many, many years? A continual improvement, right? And these improvements were disturbing to different people at different times. And so each of us is the beneficiary of generations of massive improvements and economic competition. Now, the effect of this on our standard of living is to have elevated it enormously. The reason we are where we are is because there were people who made all of these innovations, who improved the processes of production. And now we might be faced with a new competition, which causes us to lose the benefit of an acquired skill or an acquired fortune. Well, suppose we take the extreme case, someone has lost $1 million and he'll never make it back. Well, what's the effect on him? He now has to live more or less as an average worker. Well, if we ask what is the effect on his standard of living of economic competition and economic progress taken as a general phenomenon, not one isolated instance, what's the effect of economic progress on this person's standard of living, even though now he's reduced to the ranks of the average wage earners rather than being a wealthy businessman?
It's far decreased.
Pardon me?
It's far decreased.
You say it's far decreased.
In the short term, absolutely. Probably for his lifetime. He no longer can afford the servants he could. He can no longer afford that.
But what is it that enables him to buy anything? What is it that enables him to have a car, to have a television set, to go to the movies, to get an antibiotic, to have a telephone, buy food? What is it that underlies all of this?
It's inheritance.
No. Innovation. So what you're saying is, even though he lost it, it's better off for everyone because that's the way that it happens progressively throughout
time. Well, it happens progressively, and I would say an accurate description of the relationship of this individual to the phenomenon of economic competition and economic progress is that he is always an enormous positive gainer. But there can be his gain at a later time may be significantly less than it was at an earlier time. So when you're a millionaire, your gains are huge. When you're reduced to the ranks of the average worker, your gains are still enormous, but not as enormous. It's always very positive if you hold the context. Now, what most people do, or many, I should say, is they assume that the peak standard of living they ever had is theirs by some kind of divine right. And that's the starting point. That's the given, the indisputable given of the analysis. And then they only look at what pulls them down a notch or two. And they denounce whatever it is that's pulling them down a notch or two, even though that identical process is responsible for their being 100 floors above where they would otherwise have been. Yes?
Doesn't that smack of socialism, though? That,
which?
Oh, it's all for the good of the people. Well, you know, even, yes, you can go down in your standard of living so that everyone else can have an improved standard of living in the future, that type of thing.
No, so that you could have had the standard of living you have now. You would never have had it. And also, see, when you say, does this smack of socialism, what does it take to stop it? To stop the process of progress.
Oh, government intervention.
It would be government intervention. I'd like to use the example. Imagine some buggy factory owner is suffering from the competition of old Ford. Now, if he writes a letter to Ford saying, don't you realize I haven't finished putting my daughter through finishing school? Why don't you wait till I've got these responsibilities off my hands? Is that going to make Ford stop?
No.
No. So what would it take to make Ford stop?
Government
letters.
Letter to a senator.
Yeah, a letter to a senator or hire the mafia. One of the two. Less and less distinction, unfortunately. That would be government control. That would do it. It's the government interfering that would stop the process. Okay. Yes, I see. You want to call my attention to the time? Okay. Last question then, and I'll get to you after the break. Okay, Mr. Weatherford.
Talking about the potatoes.
Yeah.
If we have natural disaster,
yeah,
and that would naturally force people to put their forces together and produce more potatoes, right? So probably the price of potatoes would be higher.
If there's something that reduces the supply of potatoes?
Yeah, like natural disasters.
Okay, yeah.
Even the same analogy of creating wars.
How does this relate to wars?
That, for example, an economy would want to create a war so it can destroy something and rebuild it up. The artificial means to rebuild things.
No, there are people who believe that, but that's a fallacy. We don't gain from a process of destruction. That's the consumptionist idea. The consumptionists think we have a shortage of needs, that we don't need or desire enough. We only need or desire some fixed given amount, and a good war will add a new source of need. But our needs and desires for wealth have no limit. So the last thing that we need is artificial need creation. We don't need that. If you have a war, it's just detracting from your ability to produce other things. You don't grow prosperous by a war. You're always impoverished by war, or at least made less rich, which is not to say a country should never have a war. Sometimes it's necessary to the existence of the country and any kind of freedom, but it's always at a great expense. It's never a source of prosperity. Okay, Mr. Weatherford, then we got to break.
Any one event, such as a natural disaster that wipes out potato crops,
yeah.
Wouldn't the first reaction actually be substitution?
Well, for the time being, if there's no potatoes around or very few, to that extent, there must be substitution. But then, to the extent there's a higher price, that could be expected to stimulate production the following year. Yeah. Okay, let's take a break at our proper time, and then we'll resume.